really want to start honing in on your skills, go and start doing it because you're capable of it. On the flip side, if you want to be a lawyer or a doctor or many of the other things that take a college degree to become that thing, then you pick the best possible college that will take you, that allows you to get the job of your dreams. So, if you want to become an employee and work somewhere, I recommend it. It will help you. If you want to do something on your own, I highly discourage you to do it unless you're doing it for the work-life balance of having 4 more years of playing video games and parties and all that crap, which, oh, by the way, now that I'm 40, I probably should have done a little bit more of that, so keep that in mind.
I feel as though online courses are usurping traditional education in a big way. Do you see this happening, and is there money to be made?
Big fat yes. Between Creative Live, Khan Academy, Udemy, Skillshare, there's tons of startups putting out incredible platforms that then acquire incredible talent teaching courses on these platforms. I've taught a couple that I know are absolutely better ROI than the college professors that have been out of the game for 20 years. So the answer is yes. And do I think there's money to be made? Absolutely. I see massive fragmentation over the next 20 years where you can teach your chef course on your own website because people are used to this, or you can pay a vig to a platform if you're not big enough, or you can start off being not big enough, let a platform get 50% of the action because you're on it, and then when you get big enough, you can do it yourself and make lots of money. I'm a huge fan of this, and let me explain another thing. On this education thing, remember, how people judge is what brings value to the equation. Let me explain that statement. Because the decision makers in business today value a diploma from Michigan or Wisconsin, or highly value Yale or Columbia or Harvard, that's why it's valuable. As guys like me and gals like my friends come along and start valuing actual data to prove if you're good at something, that little piece of paper will lose value. Whoever is judging dictates the rules of the game, and this will play out over time. And somebody passing, I would tell you right now that I would hire somebody at VaynerMedia that proved to me that they went through 5 to 7 social media courses on platforms versus getting that degree from BU, where my brother went, so I'm razzing, on social media. I would believe for them to be better from the online courses than the best universities in the world today, and give that person a job. And so that's how you get into VaynerMedia. And as that becomes a platform play, as that becomes the norm, more people will do it.
What's the last new skill you learned as a result of taking an interest in someone else's passion, hobby, or job?
The truth is, I'm not very good at this. And so at the time of answering it on the show, I think I kind of lallygagged and said, you know, golf, because my brother AJ fell in love with it, and I played a bunch of times that summer. But of course, this last summer, I played a total of 0. From a business standpoint, which is why most of you are here, not to hear about my golfing game. Very recently, Jeff Nicholson joined my paid team, and he's very passionate about YouTube ads. And because I'm so passionate about Facebook ads, I didn't take a real interest in YouTube ads, but he educated me. He fought for it. He made good points. And now I'm more interested and more educated and more passionate about pre-rolls on YouTube because I understand the Google search functionalities. So I became a better practitioner through his sheer enthusiasm for the execution.
I'm a self-taught media marketer. Is it worth taking courses before applying for jobs?
Yes and no. Let me explain. One of the great skills of my life is reverse engineering the finish line. So, if you want to get a job at VaynerMedia, no. Because we're going to judge on the test that we give you, and we don't care if you came out of a rock, or if you're a Martian, or even a Patriots fan. If you pass it, we're interested. Yes, if you're going to go to a place that actually values you taking those courses. If you go to Ogilvy's or Google's or some other company's page and they say they like that and that will give you a better chance to get the job, then you do that. Understanding where you're going and where you want to be should absolutely dictate your actions. That's why yes and no.
Any tips on how to get a mentor?
So I often talk about take advice from people that have actually done it. I always get mad when people read business books from people that weren't actual businessmen or women. And so this question's tricky for me because I'm not great at having a mentor. The closest thing that I've ever had to a mentor was my dad. And even that, at the age of 16, 17, and 18, I started pushing away from. I started trying to be the mentor to my dad instead of the other way around. Much like many of my answers, I think you go out and grab it. And I think another thing that you need to think about is actually providing value to the other person. How are you going to get Mark Cuban or Damon John or Gary Vaynerchuk or Tim Ferriss or anybody else to be your mentor? How are you going to get Jack Welch, one of the greatest CEOs, to be your mentor? The answer may lie in listening instead of talking. Let me explain. I think one of the best ways to get a mentor is to go on Twitter and find the 5 to 10 people that are your dream mentors and watch what they're talking about. Find out what matters to them. For example, let's use real life examples. Damon John right now is promoting his book. Right now, if you could provide value to him selling more books by saying, I will follow you around for 16 hours a day and I will do anything you say, but by just being around you, I will soak up things that will teach me. I think that people always want things, and instead they don't think that they can provide value. Unbelievable, iconic business people are actually more open to having somebody to mentor when they have something of need of that moment. I run through times where I don't need it at all, and I would not be open to it, and I get 1,000 emails, and I won't look for it. But at times where I'm promoting or I'm scaling, I may, because I say, look, there's a value exchange here. So I think the best way to get a mentor is first to shoot high. Make a list of the 10 people in the world that you dream of. And then you kind of figure out what is important to them. And then you make a proposition. Hey, I know this matters to you. Let me help you. And I've seen this work time and time and time again. And that is my advice.
What advice do you have for professors to engage college students in the classroom? What about outside of class?
Earlier in this book, I referenced the fact that young people have more respect than we've ever seen in the boardroom. And that trickles into this question. Professors have to understand the level of disrespect that a lot of their students have against their own POVs of their professors because they understand these platforms and technologies better than the professor. And so I actually think this is a stunningly interesting answer. I think the answer is humility. I think that one of the number one things that professors need to do is actually have enough humility to acknowledge that the classroom may know more about Yik Yak or Musical.ly or Snapchat. However, these professors should know much more about the principles and the tried and true, and they should take the theses and deploy them against the transactional actions of the modern marketplace. And so they should create an environment where they're open with their classroom. Then tactically, by establishing that trust, they can start actually engaging with their students on some of these platforms, creating events where they're all learning together. Use that momentum to reach out to entrepreneurs to come in. For example, some of the best courses I've ever taught were because professors used their classroom to hit me up on Twitter and beg me to come to the university and give a talk. And so it all took the humility of the professor, and I see this every day, not saying, well, I know, and you don't, or Facebook will never amount to anything, which was so cliche. And so that religious point of view first, and then tactically to engage, once you have that trust, you can do a ton of tactics underneath that, like start Facebook groups, Snapchat with your students, a million different things that create relevancy and get them into practice of being a practitioner of that marketing instead of just hearing about it.
I'm 10 years old. Which one of your books should I read first, and when should I read it? I can't decide.
You should read this one, because it's the one that I want to sell right now, because it's the newest one. The truth is, Ask Gary Vee, I hope a lot of you see this, is kind of like a Crush It 2.0. Crush It was clearly, you know, look, the first book you put out probably in a lot of ways is your biggest truth at that point, because it's all pent up. And then you kind of go from that North Star and you talk about other things. Ask Gary Vee, this is my most complete view on not only the tactics, but the mentality, the strategy around business and entrepreneurship. So I do believe that this book right now, a very meta answer, is the answer. I do believe that Jab, 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 Right Hook is a very black and white. The reason there is no audiobook, the only one of mine that there isn't, is it's so tactical, it's so visual, that I didn't think there was value in the audiobook. It would just be such a disconnect. So I would say after getting the thesis, and the strategy and blueprint from this book to go to Jab, 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 Right Hook, because it's the most modern around actual practitioner executions.
Hey, it's Edwin again. Remember me? Here's another question. Morale in public education is at an all-time low right now. How do we create a thank-you economy despite government mandates, curricula that aren't effective today, no funding, and, most of all, high stress and pressure on teachers?
Hey, Steve. Great to hear from you again. Thanks for jumping in. Steve, listeners, I got bad news. And my sister is a teacher. The answer is, you can't. The machine is too broken. It's too big. The thought that we can switch all those things right now, government, history, infrastructure, legacy, it's just not going to happen. What's going to happen is what happens in business, which is something comes along and disrupts it. A car was invented, which disrupted the horse and buggy. Uber came along and disrupted taxi services. All of a sudden, taxi services are doing all these great things because they were forced to. They didn't want to innovate. Unfortunately, education, the way we know it, the way we all know it that are listening right now, is a broken machine in the modern information world. We live in a world where our kids are being taught information to regurgitate it, yet it is literally at their fingertips on their phone. It's just a problem. I do not believe it's going to be fixed. What I do believe is going to happen is a new version of it. If you really care about education, you shouldn't care how it's being deployed. You don't care about education and also believe in a K-12 college system. If you believe in education, you could be informed in any way, and that's what we should focus on. Putting our kids in the best position to succeed in 2020, 2030, 2040, and reading who the 9th president of the United States is and then regurgitating it 6 weeks later on a Scantron isn't the fucking answer. Chapter 4, Family Business. In this chapter, I talk about family, forgiveness, fairness, and the best decision you'll ever make. I write books for many different reasons, including the financial incentive, the extra exposure it offers, and okay, yes, my ego. But one of my driving forces when I get the idea for a book is, can I actually help somebody? Could it change the course of somebody's life? Crush It did that. 7 years after its publication, I still get hundreds of emails from people telling me how the book inspired them to follow their dreams. I hope this chapter could be that powerful for anyone in a family business or considering going into one. I've run two family businesses. The first was with my father, and the second was with my brother. They're as complicated as business gets. One of my favorite cautionary pieces of advice is that one of the best ways to go out of business is to make an emotional decision, to get romantic about how you make your money, or to let your emotions get in the way of the task at hand. We'll get to that in chapter 10. I say that, and yet I know there is nothing more emotional than dealing with the conflicts that arise within a family business. There isn't a week that I don't get emails asking, how do I get my dad to let me try something new? Or how do I convince my mom to join the 21st century? Believe me, I've been there and I feel you. I try to tread lightly because every situation has its own dynamics and variables. But there's one thing I can say that I hope is universally helpful no matter what kind of situation you're in. If you and your family love each other more than you love the business, you will succeed. My dad and I love Wine Library almost more than we love breathing. But we loved each other, just a hair enough more than the business. And that's really why we were able to make it happen. So when I read that, it was kind of emotional to me because it's just really the truth. It's really the part that most matters. And by the way, do not judge somebody who loves their business more than their family. It's bad. I understand. And if you're the son or the daughter and you know that your mom or dad likes the business or loves the business more than you, it might be very difficult to swallow. But it is a truth and something that needs to be reconciled with at times. It's just the way it is. As somebody who has two businesses, they are absolutely my children, just as much as Misha and Xander. Family businesses are complicated. For example, I know no other way of relating to my father. I mean, it's just the relationship we've always had. But there was a time when we were growing up that my brother and I had a more carefree dynamic than we do now. now that we're in the trenches of a business together. At one point, we had to start scheduling non-work-related meetings to rekindle our brotherly relationship because every time we hung out, we were talking about the negatives or the problems we had to solve. Most people advise families not to risk family harmony by going into business together. I totally disagree. I say if you have the opportunity, go in head first. I'm passionate about this topic and have spoken to a lot of people about it over the years. And even the 5 to 7 dozen I've met whose foray into business caused their families to explode like an atomic bomb to the point where they weren't even speaking to each other, sometimes for years, even they eventually admitted that they were grateful for the time they had gotten to spend day in and day out with those family members. For that reason, I feel comfortable telling you that if you're debating whether to take that leap, it's a good decision and you will not regret it. I can honestly say that there is nothing I'm more grateful for in my professional life than the opportunity I had to work with two of the people that I love the most in the world. It hasn't always been easy. It has taken a ton of emotional equity and enormous amounts of empathy, self-awareness, and compassion. But it also has honed my communication skills in a way that I can't even quantify. Who needs Stanford or Wharton when you've got a family business to school you? Despite the days I cried in my dad's office, and boy, let me tell you, there's a lot. Despite those hard conversations that I've had with my brother, I think I'm the luckiest man alive to have what I have with them.
Hi, my name is Leslie Blodgett, and I am the creator and founder of Bare Minerals, and I am so excited to be here to talk with you today. Will you force your children to partake in the business like your dad? Will you be disappointed if they don't want to?
I think the number one job of a parent is to put their kid in a position to succeed after loving them and caring and all that stuff, which I'm not skipping over. I just know the context of what we're talking about here. And so if my kids do not want to become entrepreneurs or come into the family business, I will be phenomenally happy. I will be extremely happy as long as they are following something that makes them happy, that they're passionate about. I do not want to be the cliche dad that tries to force their kids to be exactly like them. Let me get really dark with all of you right now. I secretly don't want them to go into business just in case they end up being bigger and better businessmen than me or women, and then I'd be really competitive and get all weird, and then I'd have to come out of retirement and hustle when I'm 90. The whole thing would be a real mess. So I'm very excited if my kids decide they want to go save the world because they felt guilty that they grew up with money, or if they want to just do great things because they're great kids, or if they want to be an artist, or whatever they want to be, I'm going to support that 1,000%. As a matter of fact, my parents did that. My dad and mom didn't force me to go into wine library. They just knew I was a crap student, and they knew that I was a great merchant and salesperson, and it made sense. My sister didn't go into the business. My brother didn't go into the business. And so I was very fortunate that I wasn't forced into a situation. Maybe I was coddled. Maybe I was innuendoed. But I have no interest in doing anything other than reacting to my children's passions and skills.
How important is it for your significant other to share your entrepreneurial vision? What was Lizzie's impact on building your empire?
When I was 16 years old, and me and my mom would talk about a woman's impact on a man's career, my mom would always end with, "I'm not raising a chauvinist." I couldn't comprehend as a young man how in the world my wife, or even how my mom, was massively impacting what was happening at Wine Library, or at that time, Shoppers Discount Liquors. Today, as a 40-year-old man, not boy, I've come to realize the impact that my wife Lizzie has had on my career is far greater than I realized, because though she's not at Wine Library or at VaynerMedia or sitting here reading this book, what she's done is she's allowed me the freedom and the air cover to do the things that I want, the support, the knowing when not to ask questions, knowing when to ask questions, the peace of mind in the other most important part of my life that allows me to freely and with no pressure navigate my business world, my wife's support and ability to know exactly who I am and to know it from the beginning of our relationship has been a bedrock of my success. There's no coincidence that my career took off even more aggressively after I married this girl. And so I am humbled from 24 years ago, recognizing I don't know how one can be successful in business without support at home. And things not right at home with the kids, with us, would cripple me and not allow me to do my thing.
How did you deal with the specific challenges of working in a family business?
Carefully. My answer is the same answer I have to most problems, which was communication. My dad grew up in the former Soviet Union, grew up as an only child. My grandma was very hardcore, conservative kind of lady. And so my dad is not the greatest communicator. He keeps things to himself. The way I navigated was to force my dad into conversations, because by talking things out, we were able to get through conflict. And so my answer was communication. I mean, that really trumps any tactical thing of debating on where to put the beer cooler or me and AJ deciding what offerings we should have at VaynerMedia. It's grounded in comms. Communicating between people matters. Deploying empathy and recognizing and letting them hear that I recognize their point of view or what their issues are. However, this is where I'm coming from. So good old-fashioned communication, I think, is the bedrock of a family business.
Has any business challenge ever tested your relationship with AJ? And if so, how did you work through it?
You know, the definition of testing it is probably interesting here. Has there been things that have allowed me to go home and be upset and concerned? For sure. Has there been anything that has even remotely come close to me saying this is not right? Absolutely not. Though that has happened with my father. So I definitely understand the question. And I would tell you that there's a lot of different things here. The challenges that have tested AJ and I come from a lot of different angles, including that we're different. I definitely think that AJ is one of the most efficient businessmen that I've ever met. He's very black and white, you know, crossing T's, I's. I, on the other hand, am very improv, emotional, go with my intuition. And so I struggled with already being a successful businessman and having these intuitions and AJ pushing back on me. And I was like, who do you think you are? Those kind of feelings, though I don't communicate that way. I'm not really a fighter. So, but those were the things I was feeling. He, on the other hand, would be in a position where he said, look, you've asked me to be your partner because I bring you these values, so freaking value them, right? And so the answer is sure. Here's something interesting. We've evolved our relationship. We're now 6 years in. The first 2 years, solid banter, good friction. The middle 2 years, a lot better. These last 2 years, we're struggling to fight. We've found our cadence. We've found our style with each other. But what's best for me, and we both did this well. And I think AJ grew up watching my dad and I working together, and that probably really impacted him. What we got really good at, even in those first 2 years, was making sure every conversation, the biggest of fights, even when you really wanted to throw down and fight, and I mean, like, there's real energy in the room, we would always end it with, I love you. Maybe it wasn't like, I love you. Maybe it was like, I love you. But we always ended with, I love you. And that was a good kind of thing to end these things with, because it just reset everything of like, cool, we could debate this all day long, but at the end of the day, we're bros, we're family forever, long after VaynerMedia, and let's always ground every discussion in that. So surely tested, never really tested, but you shouldn't be scared to be tested, because it leads to honest and real conversations.
What do you think AJ has learned from you in business?
Ah, man, I wish this whole book was that. Boy, do I like when people say nice things about me. By the way, on YouTube and Facebook, I'm going to give a plug here, a little commercial time. Make sure you watch it. On the show, AJ actually answered this, and I was very humbled and proud by his answers. I think the first one was perspective, right? Recognizing that this was a marathon. He said, you know, you're going to take the good with the bad. I'm very good at adversity. I'm a wartime general, everyone. And what that means is I like when business is bad. I think right now we're in peacetime. The economy's good, and there's a lot of peacetime generals. But as soon as, like, the fight goes down, they throw their hands in the air. So I think he learned that from me, and that was happy to hear. North Star. The North Star. He mentioned on focusing on what's important, the big picture. We kind of call that the North Star. If you're reminded by what you're trying to achieve, whether grow the business, change the industry, it helps you become much better tactfully day in and day out. And then finally, and this one I really think I taught him, and this is the one from afar, I think the other two he would have had, but this is the one I think I really absolutely imposed on him. I willed him to this place, which was personalization and interaction with your actual employees. Building a team by actually doing the things that a leader needs to do to build a team, which is treating everybody as an individual, really getting to know their wants and needs and their personal skills. Realizing that HR isn't a division in your company, but it needs to be the thing that sits at the highest of levels and is something that you care about, because ultimately a loyal team is usually a winning team.
If your kids want to join the family business, will you start them at the bottom?
I started from the bottom. When I got involved in my dad's liquor store business, I was getting paid $2 an hour to bag ice for 14 hours a day in a basement with employees that hated my dad because he was a tough boss from Russia. And that was as bottom as you get. I was also making $3,000 a weekend selling baseball cards when I wasn't at the store. So you can imagine it was the real bottom. If my kids decided to get involved in my businesses, it's going to be a little bit different. The size of the businesses I'm running today, as long as nothing horrible happens, are going to be very big businesses. They're going to be very, very different. I don't like when companies and entrepreneurs and moguls or empires start their kids from the bottom as show, you know, like when it's tactful. So to answer your question, even though I started from the bottom, I don't like when people pander to a narrative. I don't want to make my 40,000 employees feel good, or I'm a real meritocracy guy by making my kids start in the mailroom or from the bottom. I actually don't know the answer to this. I really don't. The fact of the matter is I respect learning craft. So if my kids could actually do work at 22 or 18, because they didn't go to college and we covered that, well, then I would let them start wherever appropriately they would be. I definitely wouldn't let them do things that they weren't capable of doing, because I think that's how you break a business. I think that's how you lose senior leadership's confidence in you. But at the same token, I wouldn't pander to the politically correct narrative of having them start at something that they are more than capable of doing. And so I guess that, thinking of elevators, you know, if the top floor is 30 and the basement's zero, if they're appropriately on the seventh floor, let them start there. And that's what I would actually do.
I'm in sales for a third-generation residential construction company and getting my at-bat. How do I increase business but keep old minds happy?
So I was very, very lucky, and I'm very prepared to answer this question, because my father, you, Sasha Vaynerchuk, if you're listening, which I know you're not because you're that way, but my dad, at 22 years old, gave me complete control of the company. Now, I'd been working there since 14 every weekend and holiday, and so you'd be stunned by what kind of body of work I had in the business by the time I was 22, but still, he was 44 years old. I'm 40. I just gotta take a second. He was 44 years old when he gave me the keys to the castle to make decisions about our lives. And so I'm indebted to that. And so I had to do things in a certain way, meaning I knew there was 4 to 5 kind of intriguing things that my dad cared about that I didn't necessarily agree with, but I knew that there was 800 other things that I could tackle before getting on those 5 hot button issues. So I would tell you, my friend, if you know what grandpa or grandma or dad and mom really care about, what gets their emotions going, stay away from those things. There's probably 800 other things that you could be doing to increase sales now. Use that to build up the business, which then will give you leverage to attack those other 5 things. And that's what I did. I built up leverage by growing the business so quickly that it gave me the audacity, the air cover, and really the permission to start attacking some of the issues that I knew my dad wasn't going to give up so easily. But I did that out of respect and love, which should absolutely be deployed when you're lucky enough to be born into a third generation company. Chapter 5, Parenting. In this chapter, I talk about building confidence in kids and colleagues, why I don't care if you're rich or poor, and why parents shouldn't be afraid of social media. Parenting, like family businesses, is an intensely personal topic. How we parent depends so much on things that are unique to us, from our financial situation, to our partners, to our family dynamics. So I'm petrified to give parenting advice, and yet I can't shy away from it because I feel so strongly that the way we are parented affects everything we do in life, including what kind of entrepreneur we might become. I often say that I was perfectly parented. Side note, That is an absolute title to one of my upcoming books. I know some of you have heard that. I'm working on it. I truly believe that the way I was raised has everything to do with how I achieved my success. I know how it feels to be the kid who marches to his own drum. I'm incredibly fortunate that I was born to parents who not only let me do that, but also encouraged me to do more of it. I observed how they instilled in me qualities that make me the man as well as the businessman I am today, and I'm passionate about their execution and would love to see it replicated everywhere. I feel like I have something valuable to say to anyone raising a potential entrepreneur or interested in helping shape and guide the next generation of industry leaders. You should only take the advice of entrepreneurs or business people who have actually built businesses, not people who have just talked about it. So the best people to turn to for parenting advice are probably people who have seen a few more cycles than I have with grown kids. However, I work with a lot of young people who tell me their stories, and I know the pressures and concerns they and their parents have had as they started their entrepreneurial journeys. I've spoken to a lot of parents about what I do and the world I do it in. I have perspectives that could ease a lot of people's concerns about what the future holds for our kids. I realize it's just one man's point of view, but from where I'm sitting, it's looking good.
Hey guys, this is Andy Dunn. I'm so excited to be asking the next batch of questions for the Ask Gary V book. As Gary's friend from Bonobos and his future life coach, I hope I do a good job with the reading. What's the number one lesson you've learned since becoming a father?
Andy, real quick, before I get into this, nobody's going to ever be my life coach. Just wanted to make sure that was established. You know, it's funny. I feel like I was practicing to be a father my whole life. You know, when you're born in another country and you immigrant to this amazing place called America with so much opportunity, you really have a great perspective as an immigrant because often one of your parents or both of your parents are working so hard. And so with my dad away so much in the first 10 years that we were in America, I spent an enormous amount of time with my mom and with my younger sister, Liz, who's 3.5 years younger. And then AJ was born and he's 11 years younger than me. I was always very much a leader. I was always kind of the guy that looked out for everybody else. I have a lot of EQ, emotional intelligence, so it made me very kind of motherly in my fatherly kind of journey. And so by having a brother who was 7 when I was 18 and already a businessman and things of that nature, I always kind of looked at AJ as my half-brother, half-child. And so by the time Misha was born, I was really there. And so the only thing it really taught me was when you have that kind of love for this thing, this creature, this person that comes into the world that's your own, it just reminds me how scared, honestly, that's really what it is. It reminds me how scared I am to have anything happen to somebody that I love. And the truth is, I'm very close to my parents, given that our journey from the old country, given that they're only 20 years older than me, I probably am a minority of somebody who can easily say right now that there's not a big distance between the way I love my parents and I love my kids. I guess having kids just reminded me of the fear of losing the loved ones around me. Really, that's the only thing that it taught me, which is to live my life in a way that reminds me that that's what I care about most, not buying the jets, not being on the cover of Fast Company, not having the accolades from all of you. It's spending time with those characters.
How exactly did your mother instill that self-confidence in you?
Propaganda. And maybe it's because my mom's from the Soviet Union that she was so good at it, but this is the damn truth. I'm going to tell you guys something right now that is so insane. At 16, now you're a big boy at 16, at 16 years old, and I was, you know, 5'4". At 16 years old, at 5'4" in a high school, I would walk around the halls of my high school literally thinking I was the best looking. And by the way, I didn't have the hottest girlfriends or any. I was the best looking, I was the smartest, and this is just how I lived life. My mom said it to me so many goddamn times that eventually I just believed it. And what she also did, which was super smart, was she exaggerated my accomplishments of selling stuff and being a good brother and a good kid and not smoking and drinking. Like, she exaggerated those things. And the things I was doing poorly, school and other things, she made me understand that that wasn't okay. She kept me respectful to it so I wasn't dissing my teachers, but she didn't dwell on it. I have so many friends right now where I see parents dwelling on the insecurities and shortcomings of their children, and it makes my heart cry. Please, you can decide what you want to focus on. My mother decided to focus on all the good things I did in the world instead of the bad.
Shark Tank's Barbara Corcoran doesn't invest in, quote, rich kids, end quote, businesses. How do you feel about entrepreneurs from privilege?
For a long time, I was with Barbara on this one. I really was. You only go by your experiences. Plus, I was rooting for myself, right? I wasn't a rich kid, so it was a fun narrative to be like, see, I stuck it to all of you that went to Harvard, right? It was a fun narrative, but the truth is, I can't be emotional about this. And what I've learned in the last 7 to 10 years is there's a lot of entrepreneurs that I can think of that grew up quite wealthy and quite privileged and are as hungry and as on fire as many others that came up with nothing. Now, do I think by percentage, people that grow up with nothing that have entrepreneur DNA have that extra fight and grip? I do. I do. I think there's a, you know, they're just trying to establish that base that a rich kid already had. And so they're valuing different things. I even think at times that some of the luxuries that I now have taken some of the fire out of my belly, though I'm really trying to work against that. And so I would say that I'm very comfortable investing in rich kids and have seen plenty of poor kids not have the makeup to be a successful entrepreneur. And so I don't agree anymore, but I would be lying if I didn't say that that's a recent phenomenon for me, only as of the last 3 to 5 years.
I'm curious to know your thoughts on tech consumption by young children.
I know I'm in the minority of this, and this is going to be one of the few places where I think people are going to rewind and listen to this again, because I know I'm in a very small minority of this. I think it's good, and I think kids should spend more time on technology. I think the kids of America and the world should spend more time in front of screens. And I know every single parent that I know right now vehemently disagrees with me. They're trying to pull away the iPad at every moment. They're sad that they're on the phone. Yet, by the way, as a side note, anytime they need their kids to shut up, they throw those iPads at them like it's the cure to all the problems in the world. Anyway, I think it would be a grave mistake to not prepare your kids for the future world. If you truly believe that screens are going away, or that technology is miraculously for the first time ever going to stop, and we're going to go back to the written word or drawing in caves, or that life is going to be more simple, you're out of your mind. And so, just like I wasn't supposed to play with video games as a kid because it was going to ruin me, or just like you weren't supposed to watch TV for 7 hours a day because you were going to be a blob, you can say anything you want, but the world is going in one direction, and I think holding back your child from the skills that are going to be their day in and day out life needs to be thought about a little bit more than we're doing now. This is evolution, my friends. Every time this happens, the outcome is very similar, which is parents think one thing because I have a news alert. Let me help you with this. Psst. That's right. You're old. You're telling the same story your dad did about walking to school in 10 feet of snow. Let me remind a lot of you millennial parents. Your ass watched 7 hours of Cosby Show. So what's the difference? And let me help you. Nothing.
In the future, how are you going to treat social media with your children?
Well, first and foremost, this is not a dictatorship, unfortunately, like my business is. I've got a real equal partner. And I'd have to even say, given the fact that she has more context on the kids by spending more time, I almost have to defer, which really... Anyway, here's a couple things. One thing that I take a lot of flack from all of you, at least the ones that are listening to this that have followed me for a long time, is work-life balance, right? Am I spending enough time with my family? What you may know is that I don't put out a lot of content around my family, right? That's the problem. If you go and try to find pictures of my kids on social media, you can't. And so because Lizzie and I decided that it's up to them on how much they want to expose themselves, you get a false picture of how much time I spend with them because I'm not storytelling to you about them. So I'm going to handle it the way we've been handling it so far, which is we're going to let them make some decisions. We're going to be vigilant. We're not confused. But I am not a headline reader. Let me explain. Just because one child has a bad experience in Phoenix on the new Instagram 7 years from now doesn't mean I'm going to allow the headline to stop me from allowing my kids to do. I'm going to look at the data, which is things like since social networks and phones that are smart and can record have been out and about in our society, kidnapping is down because it's harder to kidnap because we're all media companies walking around with recorders at all times at our fingertips. So I'm not going to do anything other than the following. I'm going to instill self-esteem and confidence and kindness and practicality and common sense to the best of my ability into my children. I'm going to allow them to navigate. I'm going to watch, right? But I'm not going to suffocate.
I'm speaking to parents at a public school event on parenting in a social media world. What would you teach them?
I would teach them to become practitioners and not headline readers. For example, every one of them right now is scared of Snapchat because they've read in headlines that kids sext and all this, that, and the other thing. Let me just give you a news alert, my friends. If your kid has a smartphone, that means he or she has access to the internet. It is a lot more likely that they're going to porn sites by typing it in, and it's so easy to do, versus the random once in a million that somebody's going to get an indecent picture through Snapchat. It's a lack of understanding, and stop being scared. Listen, this is not being educated. Being scared of Snapchat, while they have access to every porn site in the world, is not understanding what is really going on. So, get educated. Take some emotion out of the equation, which is not easy with children, and just remind yourself, Dad, you were the same guy that plotted for weeks with your friends on how to steal a Playboy from Krausers just a decade or two ago, right? And so, just 2 decades ago. So, you know, at the end of the day, we need to take a step back, take a deep breath, and understand that at one point in time, Elvis Presley shaking his hips made parents not allow kids to listen to Elvis songs. Think about it. And also, real quick, even though I loved having the Elvis punchline end that, remember, social media can be your friend. I mean, I was able to hide from my parents left and right, but right now, I know so many of my parent friends that know exactly what's going on their kids because they're following them on Snapchat and Instagram, and kids are, you know what, let's call it what it is, kids are dumb sometimes. Like, hey mom, I'm going to Sally's, and then they put up an Instagram photo at Karen's. I mean, it's just a joke. But anyway, nonetheless, if you don't look at it as a negative and actually realize it could help you if you want to know what you know, which, let's call it what it is. For a lot of you micromanagement parents, you want to know everything. And guess what? Social media is probably your best asset. Chapter 6. Hustle. In this chapter, I talk about the value of keeping your mouth shut, my formula for good health, and how to make time when you don't have any left. Here's a question that no one has yet asked me. What is the one tangible thing people can do to change the direction of their lives? Hustle. Anyone who follows sports, especially drafts, knows that a less gifted competitor can outplay the most naturally talented athlete if that competitor has more hustle. Similarly, it's hustle, not talent, that is the differentiator between entrepreneurs who succeed and those who don't. I have never seen anyone increase his or her natural talent. But I have seen people transform themselves by increasing their hustle. Of course, if you're born with a heavy dose of it woven into your DNA, you've got a terrific advantage. But the great thing about hustle is that if you're not born with it, you can get it. It's the most tangible, most easy to get entrepreneurial quality because you're in complete control of it. If you're not self-aware, you're somewhat dependent on other people being honest enough that you become cognizant of your strengths and weaknesses. I'm not even sure it's possible to teach yourself to be more intuitive. But if you want to turn up the hustle, you just have to spend more time doing whatever it is that takes you where you want to go. You just have to be willing to do more than the competition. And you have to do it every single day. It's like career calisthenics. Something people can directly apply to their work lives and see results. It doesn't guarantee you will succeed. Plenty of hardworking people don't. But it will guarantee that you won't ever torture yourself with thoughts of should've, would've, could've. Because you'll know without a doubt that you put your heart and soul and sweat all in. I'm self-aware enough to know that I have a lot of talent. But it's my work ethic, my hustle, that has been a substantial backbone to my success. I truly know I will outwork anyone. How about you? You can be a phenomenal content creator, but if you lack passion or willingness to sweat, there is someone else out there who is going to make more opportunities for herself and more money than you. Don't let that happen. Put down Clash of Clans, binge watch Game of Thrones or Walking Dead next year, and get to work.
Hi, I'm Tom Ferry, CEO of the number one training and business coaching company in the real estate industry, and I'm excited to ask Gary the next 10 questions. How do you define hustle?
Tom, thanks for doing this, brother. You're a hustler for sure. You know, I define hustle differently every time, so we'll see what comes out of here, because the truth is it's kind of like, it's like oxygen. It's like this huge, it's like God. It's like huge for me. It's maximizing every single minute. It's the passion in your heart. It's fighting through when it hurts so much. It's an energy in your stomach that doesn't allow you to fail. It's, you know what it's kind of like? It's like Rocky Balboa. It's like a Rocky movie, right? Like, even if Drago or Mr. T punched you 8,000 times in a row in your face, you still are just going. It's the extra mile, the extra effort. It's the energy that completely is infectious around everyone around you because they can just tell you're squeezing harder, you're running faster, and you're doing it for longer than everybody around you.
Is hustle something that can be taught?
Remember, hustle allows you to pounce on every opportunity. It allows you to work towards gaining true exposure, which can allow incredible business results. And it allows you to create one more great piece of content when everybody else is sleeping. Hustle allows you to work on 5 hours of sleep instead of six. It allows you to make one more business meeting at 11:30 at night. It allows you to bring more value to somebody else that they now feel guilty and they want to provide you value the next time. It's all of that. I think that watching my parents work their faces off, my dad, my mom at home raising three kids, no help, no babysitters ever, no cleaning, nothing, no help, absolutely instilled it in me. And more importantly, the reason I can emphatically say yes, and I know that if you've been listening, I hedge a lot because there's a lot to be hedged in the world. I've watched every employee that's been close to my center, all my direct reports, all my assistants, all my trainees, the people I've mentored, become stronger hustlers by watching my behavior. I don't know if it becomes a guilt that I'm working 16 hours a day and they don't think they can get away with six. I don't know if they see the fruits of it. I don't know if they realize, oh my God, it actually does take that. I'm not sure. But to answer it directly, 100% hustle can be taught. That is something I absolutely know to be true.
What's your number one piece of advice for marketing a lean, local, city-based social startup?
Oh, I remember this one because there's something Tom left off that really got me going, which was, in addition to that, it said that still undeveloped. And that got me going. What got me going here was this. My number one advice was, don't worry about your marketing plan when you haven't even built the product. Like, figuring out how to sell Nike sneakers before you even invented the Nike sneaker makes no goddamn sense. So why don't you focus? And this is what happens. I've literally had kids come to me and say, Gary, what should I do with my millions of dollars once I make them? How should I invest it? And I'm like, are you goddamn serious? You haven't made a dollar yet. And that becomes just not practical and really lacks any sensibility. So my number one advice is, first of all, build the product, because as you build the product, you might learn something about the product that may change the way you market it. To come up with a marketing plan for something that doesn't exist yet lacks the knowledge of how to build an actual business, which is one step at a time.
What is your advice for small business owners with a limited budget? Is it local listings, SEO, writing content, social media?
Sure. and so that's the funny part to this answer. The answer is so many things, right? Create content, start a YouTube show, go to networking events in town, do social media. Like, these kind of questions bother me because I think people know the answers. The tactics are out there. There's so many established things. I think the thing that bothers me is just go and do it, right? This is really, a irritating question. I mean, Google AdWords, it works. Banner ads, it works a little bit. Email marketing, it works. Facebook, it works. Instagram, it works. Going to networking events to sell chocolate because you're a chocolate store, it works. I think the real answer is just to work more, right? That's my biggest advice, because I feel like it's something you can control. But to rattle off local listings and SEO and writing content and social media, means that you know. And limited budgets means that you just do less of it for things that cost money, but you could be doing more of it, and which means you have to sacrifice. Look, you either have money or you have time and talent. You have to sacrifice time and talent when you don't have money. So that's what you should be doing more of. You should be doing more of this stuff, and less of things that take you away from it if you want to. Again, I'm going to say it again. I said it before. If you have the audacity to live a life on your own terms, you being your own boss, you making enough money to go on vacations and have nice things and all the great things that come with a business, well, then you have to put in the work. Like, you have to give up something in the beginning.
What would you do if you were starting over and trying to get the name Gary V out there today?
I would do the same thing I actually did, which was, if you look at my career from 1998 to 2006, in that 8-year window, you can't find anything that I did publicly. No talking, no blogging, no video conference, nothing. You just can't find me, because I put my head down and I executed my business, which allowed me to grow a very large business, which then allowed me to have the audacity to start talking about business and trends and theories and things of that nature. So first and foremost, I would earn my keep. I think too many people are out there are 23-year-old business life coaches, where their entire business life is telling other people what to do, yet they've never done it. That's how they make their money. It's ludicrous. It's not practical. It's silly. And it pisses me off that so many people fall for it. So I would go out, execute, and then I would regurgitate what I learned in that decade and apply it against the current landscape. The things I learned about email marketing and Google AdWords are not relevant today anymore in detail, but the theory of open rates and click-through and how attention works with the end consumer and the psychology of mobile devices versus inboxes, those are all relevant. So I would go out and become a practitioner and execute, and then I would speak about it. And that's what I would do. I would just replicate what I did.
When you have a billion-dollar potential business plan without financial resources and inventory, where do you start with funding?
Boy, does this question smell bad from afar for me. I mean, if you have a billion-dollar idea, if that's so great, you should have no problem getting funded. I don't know. Go to the richest uncle you have, or ask around your neighborhood to find out who's got the most money in town. Or, I don't know, do what everybody else does, which is go to Silicon Valley and hang out around coffee shops and find people that invest. There's also angel.com, a huge list of every angel investor in the world. Or, if your idea is so great, why don't you start a Kickstarter? Go to Kickstarter.com, tell the world your idea, and let them fund it. I have a funny feeling it's not a billion-dollar idea. I just do. People that have billion-dollar ideas don't ask questions about how to raise money on billion-dollar ideas. And this anxiety that I have right now stems from something quite simple, which is too many people are caught up in their ideas. And everybody thinks they have a billion-dollar idea. And everybody has ideas. What actually builds the biggest companies in the world is the execution. And everybody running around saying, oh, I had that idea, or I have this idea, are just talking. And I hate words without action. I really do. Actions speak much louder than words. And so what I would recommend is for you to go out and either start building it so that people can see it. And I mean that on a shoestring budget, or it's very easy to get to venture capitalists. They all have websites. Email them. Tell them you have an idea. Give them a little hint of what it is. If it's a billion-dollar idea, I have a funny feeling that every VC is going to be coming to you. P.S. I don't think you have a billion-dollar idea.
Do you respond to posts, tweets, and messages yourself, or do you have your staff do it for you?
The one thing that I'm most proud of in my last 7 years of being a public internet figure, because I don't want to hyperbolize what I'm up to, is that every tweet, every Facebook comment, every Instagram comment, every Snapchat chat that you've gotten from my account is me. And that is something that is a minority, A lot of celebrities or people with big communities have people doing it for them, but I believe that that is not authentic. I truly do. I think you think you're talking to that person. It's not like it's Team Gary or the Ask Gary V book account. This is me, Gary, and I've put in the time and effort, and I believe that energy into the world is meaningful. And so the answer is, it's all me. It will always be me. When I make that switch, it will be obvious. And what I mean by making that switch, if I decide to do what I did with my Facebook fan page, which is turn it into a content push platform, I might not be pushing the content, but any comment and reply that has my face on it, that says that's my official account and it's me, that's me.
Do you work 7 days a week?
Depends on how you define working. In my brain, probably more than I like to admit, though that's probably the thing I'm most working on, which is shutting off so all my attention and energy is going towards my family on the weekends, vacations, things of that nature. Early on in my relationship with Lizzie, I did work a lot of 7 day weeks and things of that nature. I don't anymore. Obviously the two little munchkins at home deserve a lot of that physical time, but I actually think this is more interesting around the mental time. I have a lot of friends who are like, I'm a great dad. I get home at 5:30 every day. And then I say, yeah, but you played 2 hours of Call of Duty as soon as you get home, and you're on the softball team, and you go out. And more importantly, when little Ricky's in the room, you're watching the Knicks game. You're really not paying attention. And so I think mental time is something that I'm hacking at and that I am calling so many of you out. Just because you're physically there doesn't mean you're there. And that's something that we all have to be thinking about. So the answer is not anymore, because I'm really, really hacking at, you know, either Saturday and Sunday, a Saturday, and definitely on vacation time, I'm really trying to be mentally there, but it is very hard for me to turn off. This is my passion. I love my businesses. They're my third child, my fourth child. And so I struggle with that as much as anybody else, but physically, no. Mentally, no, but only just now starting to get there.
How do you avoid procrastination so well?
Mainly because I only talk about the things that I don't procrastinate around, which is business. I procrastinate a lot of things, like throwing out the trash, doing all sorts of paperwork, like anything I don't like, I procrastinate. The best way to not procrastinate is to only do things you like, because then you'll actually do them. I mean, procrastination is something I think I have a ton of. Now, the way I've been able to stop procrastinating certain things within my business, to give a little bit more value to this question, is I've surrounded myself with other people. By now having a full-time assistant, by now having a production team around my content, by having very senior financial and operation leadership and partners, I've been able to be much better because I have human infrastructure surrounding me to make sure I don't drop the ball on something that needs to get done right away.
Gary, are you a morning person?
No. And yes, let me explain. Historically, no. As many of you know, 18 months ago, I started taking care of my health, so I am a little bit more now. Getting a quick workout in at 5 or 6 or 7 a.m. is clearly helping that a little bit. But I hate this question, and I'll tell you why. I'm so mad at people that try to impose on everybody that being a morning, the early bird gets the worm. Well, what about the worms that come out at midnight? And I think that's the important part of this question, which is, it doesn't matter if you're a morning or night person. As a matter of fact, with technology now, we see a lot more people being productive 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3 in the morning. Me included. I am sharper, more productive on momentum. So at 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, I'm still rolling, and I've used the whole day's momentum to be sharp and really on. And so I would tell you that I'm not so worried about if you're a morning or night person. I'm more worried about what you're getting accomplished in the 12 or 14 hours that you're executing, or 7 or 2. So don't think about it as morning. Think about it as, what are you getting done? As the world becomes more 24 hours, as the world becomes more global, it's not necessarily that you're winning because you got up at 7 a.m. on the East Coast. Just not as practical as it used to be.
Hey everybody, I'm Jason Fried, the co-founder and CEO of Basecamp. It's an honor to read the next questions for the Ask Gary V book. Let's go. How do you deal with burnout?
Jason, first of all, thank you so much. Guys, if you don't know who Jason Fried is, Google it. He's incredible. Burnout. I actually deal with this in a very interesting way. First and foremost, I have to say, because I'm doing what I love so much, it happens infrequently. Even though I'm working a lot, I don't burn out because I think burnout comes more emotional than physical. And so the way I deal with it is actually quite weird. So stick with me. When I feel burnt out, and that means like, screw this, I don't want to do this anymore, I want to sell the business, and whatever, all the, you know, kind of hyperbole that will come out of one's mouth when you're really sad and burnt out, I actually take a step back and I make pretend that my mom died in a car accident. And I know this is weird, and stick with me, but I get myself very quickly into a place where I put things into perspective. No matter how bad it is at that moment, something that happens in my real life, right, in my family life that is that tragic. And by the way, I'm smart enough to know that that happens every minute of every day to some other human being. So this isn't some crazy aliens are going to come and kill us. No, real things that are real tragedies, being, you know, being diagnosed with cancer that is not curable. These are things that we all know exist. And when I take a step back and say, yes, I might have lost that piece of business.